Save big on everything you need when you shop at Menards. Spidey Electric smart home products make everyday living simply smarter. Stay connected to home while you're away with wireless outdoor security cameras. Control all your smart home products from anywhere using one easy-to-use app. View our entire selection of Fight Electric smart home products today on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for other great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. We're up to segment number four of our coverage. Let's head to the courtroom.
If you'll have a seat, adjust that microphone for me. If you'll state your name, spell your last name for the record.
Kenneth Lee Kinsey, K-I-N-S-E-Y.
Welcome back, Dr. Kinsey.
Welcome.
It feels like a year since you were here. You were qualified last week as an expert, correct?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
What I would like for you to do right now is just to remind the jury, give them a little bit of background on your education, your work history, your credentials that made you qualified to be an expert witness.
Yes, sir. I've got a degree from Clemson University. A master's degree, that's undergraduate, a master's degree from Troy University, a PhD from Walden University. I have formerly been certified by the International Association for Identification two different times for crime scene investigation and reconstruction. I've worked approximately 800 death scenes in my career, and I've handled and processed countless evidence in crime scene and the crime scene related disciplines. I have completed and passed proficiency in those disciplines as recommended by the International Association for Identification, which includes oral exams, research, technical work, and also I worked under a qualified examiner for a determined amount of time. And I've been a police officer for approximately 30 years in various capacities.
And just to remind the jury, you were qualified as a forensic or crime scene forensics expert in this particular case.
Yes, sir, I was.
And real quick, what other types of qualifications as an expert do you possess?
I'm also a firearms instructor for handguns, shotguns. They call them patrol rifles, but that includes subguns, fully automatic and semi-automatic platforms. I have endorsements through the South Carolina Criminal Justice Academy. I'm also a SLED concealed weapons permit instructor, and I'm formerly a law enforcement firearms instructor through the NRA.
Now, you've had an opportunity to review the case file for this particular case, correct?
Yes, I have.
And you have actually been out to the crime scene, correct?
I have.
Beg the court's indulgence. I would like to show you what's been previously marked as State's Exhibit 526. Do you recognize this map?
Yes, sir, I do.
And what is it?
That's a satellite map from the Moselle property.
I would like to offer this into evidence. I assume no objection.
No objection. Submit it.
Dr. Kinsey, we're going to keep our testimony today narrowly focused and tailored to a few witnesses that the defense put up this past week. Did you have the opportunity to observe one witness named Michael Sutton, who was a forensic mechanical engineer for the defense?
I did.
Now, do you recall any of his conclusions or what his main conclusion was regarding the size of the shooter?
I do.
What was that conclusion?
5'2" to 5'4".
I would like now, Doug, if you would, I would like for you to publish cut on Defense Exhibit 140. Go to page 49. Okay, now what I want to do is we're going to get into this in just a moment, but they published this into evidence last week. And do you recognize these green lines coming out?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, and what do those green lines represent?
Those green lines represent a predicted static angle or I don't know what you would call it, trajectory for possible shooters.
And Doug, if you would go to page 74 of this presentation, please. Do you recognize this photo on page 74 of the defense exhibit?
I do.
And what is it?
It is Mr. Sutton pointing a pump-action shotgun into the feed room at Moselle.
Okay, and did Mr. Sutton develop his conclusions as to the height of the shooter based on math that he did in this particular case?
He said it was trigonometry, but yes, sir, he did.
Based on your many years of law enforcement experience, education, and training, what is your overall opinion on his conclusions?
I think his intentions are well, but I think his methods were flawed.
So what I want to do is I want to go back, and there were three previous angles that we just looked at in the previous slide, correct?
That is correct.
And then he also determined an angle here in this photo, correct?
That is correct.
And those are the angles that he used to determine the height of the shooter, correct?
That is correct. And Mr. Wilson, I don't know the totality of what he considered, but that was one of the elements, one of the criteria he used.
Okay, just to refresh the jury's recollection, Doug, if you go to page 4, it should be state 62. It's a picture. What is that a picture of?
That is a picture of what's been described as a quail pen.
Go to page 5, please. And what is that a picture of?
That is a close-up of that quail pen, and it has weathered cardboard on one end.
Okay, and that, for the record, is Exhibit 63 that is a picture of. And go to page 6, which should be State 64. And what is that a picture of?
That is a close-up of what appears to be a bullet defect or bullet damage in that cardboard.
Okay. Now, they base their angles, of at least two angles. Let's back up. There were two angles taken from this particular one bullet hole. Why is that?
There were. I believe the original crime scene agent gave a possibility of two angles of the angle of impact in the cardboard.
Okay. And what are some things that someone can determine from examining a bullet hole in this cardboard?
Well, the first thing is direction. It lets you know that you had one or at least one projectile fired from that direction. It's a pretty good indicator for direction.
Okay, what's another thing that you can determine?
Sometimes you can determine the angle of impact and whether that bullet was affected before it struck that object. And what I mean is, was it deflected by flesh, or did it hit its target, or is there an internal problem with the weapon that would cause that bullet to be off center?
Are you comfortable with the direction that was determined by Special Agent Worley in this particular photo?
I'm very confident of that direction.
Okay. The defense determined that there were two potential angles. How confident are you that the methodology used to determine those angles are accurate?
I have zero confidence from this piece of evidence as far as establishing angles.
So that's interesting. You feel good about the direction of the bullet going into the quail cage, but you have a concern about the angle, correct?
That is correct.
Do you have a concern about the angle?
The angle of impact, yes, sir, that is correct.
What are two things that could affect the angle of impact on a surface like this cardboard?
As I mentioned before, you could have, that bullet could have hit an object, which we don't know, or it could be an internal problem with the firearm that causes it. When you think about, if I could explain,
yes.
When you think about a quarterback throwing a football, they spin that football and it makes it stable in flight. Well, a projectile coming out of the muzzle of a firearm, a single projectile firearm, works the same way. You've got little lands and grooves in that barrel. And as that propellant pushes that projectile down the barrel, it twists. Now there's different twists depending on the firearm, but that twist, called rifling most commonly, that's what my grandfather called it, but it makes that bullet stable in flight. Anything that can throw that projectile off of battery, whether it be striking something or a firearm problem, maybe fouling too much lead in the barrel, those kind of things will make that bullet off center. Now, it still may go the general direction, but the rotation of that projectile could be off just a little bit when it strikes a target.
So a good analogy would be a lineman getting his hand on a football and making it go wobbly, but it keeps going, correct?
That would work. Yes, sir.
Ding.
I'll leave the witness.
Doug, could you zoom in on this hole real quick? Dr. Kinsey, I'd like to ask you to step down here, and for demonstrative purposes, I'd like you to demonstrate how a angle of impact can be affected in cardboard with a dowel.
Yes, sir.
Describe to the jury what you've done with this box.
I've placed four strategic holes in this box representing a bullet defect in cardboard. As you probably saw in the photographs, as a crime scene investigator, we use dowel rods to help determine direction and angle of impact. Now, they can be as simple as a wooden dowel rod like you get at your hardware store, or they make some real complicated ones made out of fiberglass if you can afford it. You know, most agencies and most crime scene teams will use a fiberglass rod, but the wooden rods, as long as they're pretty straight and true, they work just the same. So if this represents a projectile defect in cardboard, and may I say weathered cardboard, because this has been out there at least a year and a half since this incident took place. You place that dowel rod in that defect, and then you can get an approximate angle or angle of impact on it, but you can definitely get a more confident direction. If your shooter's over here and he's shooting this direction or over here or up or down, but it's not the end-all, be-all, and I can explain that to you also.
Okay. So how could you demonstrate how, well, back up a second, and step away so the jurors can see this photo, if you would. You saw the, I might need you up here.
Call and I will come.
You saw the defense expert's testimony, Mr. Sutton, I believe, last week, describing this hole. Can you explain to them how he determined the angle of impact based on what he was observing in this bullet entry?
I can, Mr. Wolf.
Please do so for the jury.
What Mr. Sutton did with geometry and trigonometry and a whole lot of tools, but basically a protractor, as we use when I testified previously, if you had a confident bullet defect, you can run a string and then put a level or it's a type of protractor, it's a bullet angle finder on top of that rod, and you can get a general angle of impact in a fixed object. However, this isn't a fixed object.
He referred to that little mark around 3 o'clock. What did he call that?
I think he called it a bullet wash.
Could it be a bullet wipe?
Bullet wipe, yeah, something okay. Like, it's not a term I use, but
okay.
I'm familiar with it.
And what was he assuming that bullet wipe was caused by? Based on the testimony you heard?
From the angle. He's assuming
the angle of what?
The angle of impact.
Okay. What else could cause that?
As we mentioned, striking a surface beforehand, fouling in the barrel, something internal. It just throws the bullet off course a little bit. It's not spinning the way it normally spins. So when it strikes, it doesn't strike. It doesn't enter the way it normally would. It wallers a little bit, like that football we talked about.
What about the dowel rod?
Well, the purpose of inserting the dowel rod is to try to get the best angle or the best direction you can. And in a perfect world, the angle would be fairly confident, like another bullet defect we're going to talk about. Remember, this is weathered cardboard. So once that examiner, and these rods are not caliber specific either, because a crime scene investigator or an examiner can't look at a bullet hole and guess what caliber it is. That's nonsense. So you try to pick the one that fits the hole the best. And with some of the fancy kits, you get a little shim kit with some little rubber grommets that you can place in there, make it fit a little bit better. But more typically, you just pick the dowel rod that's closest to the hole.
Could a dowel rod affect the angle of impact?
Upon me inserting this dowel rod, I can do damage to that bullet defect. But more importantly, when I remove it, I could do damage. And it's very deceptive damage. It's not intentional, but it can damage the angle of impact, especially in a soft, unreliable object like cardboard.
You can return to the stand. Thank you.
Yes, sir. demonstrate the happiness of the
Please, go ahead.
What I'm saying, once a crime scene investigator gets what they need, they get their photographs, their measurements, their direction. So now this dowel rod's here. And none of us know this unless you've got a video of the examiner taking that dowel rod out. So we don't know what direction he or she might have pulled that dowel rod out because she's got her measurement. She or he is not considering someone coming behind them and measuring again for something in a piece of cardboard. And we're not talking about in wood or sheetrock, we're talking about cardboard. If you pull it to the right, you cause that same bullet wipe that we got in the photograph. Likewise, if I pull it to the left, now it looks like that projectile has entered from a left to right direction. And you can go on and up or down. That'll influence the appearance of that bullet defect because you've got an object like cardboard, something that there's no confidence in.
Thank you. You can set that down. So do you recall what the defense expert testified to the direction and angle of that particular angle of impact?
I do.
And what was it?
I think 1 and 3 degrees.
But do you remember, like, was it left
going
to
up.
Right, right to left?
Going up.
And from what way to what way? What direction to what direction?
Left to right, or right to left.
Right.
Yes, sir, right to left. I have to think about the quail pen in my head.
Are you confident that the direction was correct on this?
Yes, sir. I have no reason not to believe the direction. I mean, that would have to be a huge defect hole for it to throw the direction off.
How confident are you in the angle of this?
I have zero confidence in that angle of the bullet entry.
Doug, if you could go to page 21, which I believe is a picture of State's Exhibit 38. Can you describe for the jury what that is right there?
Like the first defect, this is also a defect in a wooden, it's been described as a doghouse.
Now, you can also determine the angle of impact and the direction here, correct?
I can.
What degree of certainty do you have that they were right in the angle of impact and the directions in the doghouse?
I place a lot more confidence in this angle because that wood is fixed. It'll show a much truer projection of the angle of impact.
Can you, hold on 1 second. How is this particular, I think you just described it, but real quick, how is the doghouse different from the quail cage in determining the angle of impact?
Well, the doghouse, if you look at it, is at least a half inch to 3/4 thick. So like I said, you've got a stable, dependable bullet defect. The cardboard is 2 pieces of brown paper with corrugated paper in between to cause, you know, for strength purposes. But as I mentioned, not only is the cardboard, in my opinion, not a good substance to shoot into, it's also weathered, so that makes it even weaker.
Doug, can you go to page 42 on this exhibit? All right, it doesn't have an exhibit number at the top, but this is page 42 on Defense Exhibit 40. Can you describe what this photo is?
Yes, sir. That is a computer animated drawing of some potential trajectories into that quail pen.
And the two gray boys here, what are they?
They are, they're two figures that were placed in that CAD presentation to represent shooters.
Go to 46 of the same exhibit and describe what this is.
This is one animated suspect, I guess, or shooter placed in a similar CAD drawing, photograph, animation.
Okay, now go to page 49. And what is, sorry, go back, that's the picture I wanted. So there's 3 angles represented in this picture, correct?
There are 3 angles.
Two of them are from the same hole, correct?
Yes, sir.
One of them is from the doghouse, correct?
That is correct.
You believe that the doghouse angle is fairly reliable?
I do.
You question the quail house angle, correct?
I place no confidence in that angle from the quail pen.
Explain for the jury, and you observed the defense expert last week talking about this, how did they come to determine, based on these lines and where these gray figures are placed, how did they come to determine their heights were between 5'2 and 5'4? We'll get to your opinions about that in a moment, but just explain for them how the defense expert got to that decision.
The defense expert said he tried plugging in different heights, and he had to place those animated figures on a plane, that laser line, and he determined that they go back and forth on that plane to achieve the defects that are documented by the original crime scene examiner.
Doug, go to page 51 real quick. Let's see if that's the... So, there's some yellow placards here on the ground. You see them?
I do.
And what do those yellow placards represent?
Cartridge cases that were found on the ground. They're markers, so, you know, once you find the cartridge cases, you put them there for documentation purposes, photography, and sketching purposes.
And why, explain to the jury what the defense has determined that their angle is based on those static lines, those green lines, correct?
That is correct. Back and forth on that one static line for one angle and one static line for the other angle.
And they've placed them right there at that particular location. Why?
I think the defense expert was taking into consideration the location of the cartridge cases, and he was showing how it would fit those 5'2" animated figures that he placed in that presentation.
Is it your understanding, and I'll demonstrate, the gray figures are holding the firearm, and those gray lines represent like a string. They would run up and down, correct?
Yes, sir. That was the testimony. You go back and forth on this green line.
Okay. And that they would be right here because this is where the shell casings are. The shell casings are ejecting, correct?
That is how I understood his...
What?
Restate the question.
I'll restate the question. Why would they be placed right there in that particular location along that static green line?
Because they were in proximity to some of the shell casings.
Okay. Can you explain for this jury why their assumptions on the math they did are incorrect in determining that the shooter had to be between 5'2 and 5'4?
Well, there's a bunch of variables. Variables do matter. There are a bunch that you would have to consider. First, you'd have to consider this to be a static crime scene. Very little movement, and when it is movement, it's controlled movement. Second, you would have to place some confidence in that angle of impact on that cardboard. Third, as I testified in my previous testimony, we're not able to test fire or with confidence what we know to be the weapon used in this situation with the same ammo. And they don't throw the ammo the same place every time. It may be in the general vicinity, but as I said, I believe in my previous testimony, if you knew exactly where it was going to throw that cartridge case, you could carry a bucket with you and sit that bucket, and all your cartridge cases would go in the bucket. But like we see in the sketch and in the animated drawing, those cartridge cases are throughout. They're in a, you know, pretty large little area. And what I also saw that I noticed from this CAD drawing is there's cartridge cases to the left of these animated shooters, which means that sometime at least two of these shots were fired with the shooter far to the left and not on this static green line.
Could you come down here real quick and point out what you're talking about as it relates to the location of the shell casing?
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure if this is a shell casing here, Mr. Wilson, but right here, that is a shell casing, and it would not eject this direction in any situation depicted here in the presentation. It's not a left-handed, nobody's ever testified it was a left-handed AR-15, and like I said, they're kind of uncommon, and if it is, and that's a left-handed, then we couldn't explain the majority of them being to the right. So that's what makes this static line flawed.
Thank you.
Please. And in another photograph, you can actually see a larger area of cartridge cases back here.
Thank you. Let's assume for a minute that the angles are correct. And they very well could be, correct?
They could be.
Why is the defense's theory as to the height of the shooter represented in this picture still wrong? What else could affect it?
Distance and height.
Would you like to take a moment to demonstrate for the jury what you're talking about?
Weapon position. Yes, sir. Will you tell me which angle you'd like me to demonstrate first?
Well, let me ask you this question before you step down. Can a person be on their knee and get the same angle and be standing and get the same angle?
Yes, sir.
Can a 6'4" person and a 5'4" person still shoot the same angle, just at different distances?
Absolutely.
Can you demonstrate for the jury why that is one way that this could have changed their math?
I can.
Please.
I measured this depth on the witness box during the break. It's 8 inches. I used to be 5'11", but as I get older, I'm about 5'10". But if I'm here, or I could be 5'8", or 5'2", or 5'4", here I'm 5'10", here I'm 6'6", and here I'm even over 7 foot, and I've still got the same angle. I have just added a little bit of distance to it. And as far as the quail pin angle, I'm 21 inches from the floor to my knee. I measured it. I believe it was testified that the defendant is 25 inches between the floor and his knee. So there's 4.5 to 5 inches difference in our heights. Here, I'm probably at 4'10", if I'm shouldering this weapon. And I don't know the mechanics or how it got this way, I'm just saying it's possible. Here, I'm at 39, 38 and some change. Or I can even take it lower or higher. And please don't ask me to demonstrate that twice, because I don't think my knees can do it again.
I think I heard him crack.
Yeah. But that takes me to 36 inches, 37 inches. With the defendant, it would be about 39. So it's definitely possible. Even from a shoulder weapon, it's possible. And we do not know how the weapon was being held.
From what you've observed in this crime scene, was Maggie moving at the time she was shot?
This was a very dynamic crime scene. I believe everything was moving. The victims and the suspect were moving.
And how do you know that?
Well, suspect would be the different firearms evidence, the cartridge cases. Like I said, there's no absolute. They're not going to throw them the exact same spot, but they will throw them in a similar direction. We've got cartridge cases in a pretty nice size perimeter. We've got them at different locations from where Miss Maggie Murdoch's body, the final resting place, and different angles and different positions in different directions. So that tells you it's very fluid and it's very dynamic.
So if I'm holding a gun and I'm moving and shooting, what is happening with those shell cases as I move?
They are moving as they're ejected.
Where was Maggie's head pointing when she hit the ground?
Miss Maggie Murdoch's head was pointed in the direction of Paul Murdoch, where his body rested, back toward the feed room.
What is your opinion of the defense's expert that says the shooter could not have been 6'4" tall like the defendant, Alec Murdoch?
I think that's a flawed opinion.
Could it have been a 6'4" person?
It could have been a 5'4", 6'4", or in my opinion, a 7'4", as I just demonstrated.
Doug, let's go to page 59 in the defense exhibit 140. That should reflect state's exhibit 57. Dr. Kinsey, can you describe that picture for the jury?
Yes, sir, I can. That is a shot from inside the feed room, that back window pane where the buckshot exited Paul's left arm and then continued and exited the feed room.
Please go to page 67. Should be states 45, I believe. And what is that right there?
That's a pink string from the window to a pine tree.
And then go to page 69. And what is that a picture of?
I don't know if it's the same pink string, but it's also a pink string coming out of a window.
Okay. And go to page 74. And that is labeled exhibit 54. And what is that a picture of?
That's a picture of Mr. Sutton with what looks like a pump action shotgun pointed down into the feed room.
And what do you notice about the angle that he's holding the shotgun and the angle of the string?
Well, the string is parallel.
Let me correct you. I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. What is the defense's theory right here represented in this picture?
I've heard so many theories, but I really believe Mr. Sutton was trying to show that the angle wouldn't match if it was a taller shooter shooting into the feed room.
Okay. Doug, I'm not quite sure what page it is, but I think it's two back. Go back one more. There you go. That's it's the labeled Exhibit 53, and what is that a picture of?
That's a picture of Mr. Sutton holding, I believe, the same shotgun, more parallel to the floor.
And what is he trying to demonstrate in this photo?
I believe he's trying to follow that pink string to that pine tree or whatever got him to that pine tree.
Do you recall from his testimony how he got that angle?
I do, sir. Mr. Sutton testified that he got to where he believes Paul was standing, and he got down and he peeped through the hole in the window, the one that he thought would match that corresponding defect in that pine tree, and he ran a string to that defect in that pine tree.
Are they trying to determine the angle of the shot is exactly the way the shotgun's being pointed?
Well, I believe they were trying to determine trajectory path of that projectile.
What is flawed about this?
Guys, with a rifle, you're talking about a single projectile, and most people understand the distinction. If you can find where it was fired and you can get a perfect impact, sometimes that'll give you an idea of the path of that projectile. With a shot shell, you're talking about 9, 12, or 16, in this case, 9 buckshot pellets. They're packed in a shot shell with filler, it's like a styrofoam material. They're packed in a shot shell. When that cartridge, the primer of that cartridge is ignited and those pellets exit the muzzle of that firearm, they start to spread. We've heard a lot of testimony about that. They start to spread, and they spread in a cone. Okay, you got some at the top, some bottom, some left, and some right. And the more the distance becomes, the greater they spread. They're not like a mother duck with the ducklings right behind it and all the buckshot are in line. So you can't get a true trajectory on this shotgun. You can't even measure a true pattern, not even close to a pattern, with one pellet. So it's my opinion that that pellet that definitely impacted that pine tree, that's the top of the cone. So you've still got a bottom and you've got two sides of that cone, and unfortunately none of those pellets were located.
So, in your professional opinion, can you exclude a 6'4" defendant like Alec Murdoch, or anyone for that matter at that height, from shooting that shotgun at that angle?
Absolutely not.
When the defense expert says that the shooter has to be between 5'2" and 5'4", do you disagree with that?
I do disagree with that, wholeheartedly.
With what degree of certainty do you think they're wrong in their conclusions?
I just think it's an unknown. I mean, there's many more variables you have to know. How the shooter was holding the gun. You know, how his proportion to legs matches up with body. I mean, that's something that we're all a little bit different. And I don't, unless you've got a video of that or someone tells you how they held a weapon, I think the notion that being able to look at this evidence and determine that is unscientific.
You said something a minute ago. You said there's so much we can't know. Could the shooter have been running laterally?
Certainly could have.
Could the shooter have been running toward Maggie?
Certainly.
Maggie was certainly moving, correct?
In my opinion, she was.
Could the shooter have been on their knees?
Could have been.
But there's no way to know for sure, correct?
That's an unknown, yes, sir.
And because there's so many unknowns, there is no way the defense expert can definitively exclude a 6'4" person from shooting the rifle and the shotgun, correct?
The defense?
Cannot be the witness.
In your opinion, can the defense, based on what you just testified to, exclude a 6'4" person from being the shooter and either weapon?
In my opinion, no. The defense witness is relying on math and absolute. And in crime scene investigation, sometimes there are no absolutes.
Dr. Kinsey, have you ever observed a contact wound to the head by a shotgun?
Yes, sir, I have.
How many times have you observed a contact wound to the head by a shotgun?
After the fact, I've seen several dozen, maybe three dozen. But I also had a gentleman that committed suicide in front of me, probably from me to you.
How many times have you actually seen either photos of a contact wound to the back of the head with a shotgun in your professional career?
Probably a dozen. Out of that three dozen, probably 24 of them were suicides or someone taking their own life, probably a dozen. Execution killings.
Can you describe for the jury what kind of trauma a face, and I know they've heard from a pathologist, but in your experience as an expert in crime scene forensics, can you describe the kind of trauma you have observed in your career with contact wounds to the back of the head or any part of the head?
Yes, sir, I have.
And specifically to the face.
Generally speaking, whether it be a shotgun or a large caliber handgun, the result is similar. You feel as though the forehead and the facial features have went away, and that's a kind way to put it. They're actually there, but they've been shredded. And the pathologist can actually put those features back in place, or the majority of it. But looking at it, it looks like from the teeth up, the person went away. It's just a mess.
Dr. Kinsey, I would like to show you what's been marked as State's Exhibit 486. Can you look at that and say if you've seen that picture before?
Yes, sir, I have.
And what is the picture of?
It's a picture of Paul Murdoch at autopsy.
And what part of Paul Murdoch is it a picture of?
His face and his forehead.
Does his face look like it suffered the kind of trauma you have observed in the past from a contact gunshot wound to the back of the head or any part of the head?
No, sir, other than some red features from, you know, falling on the cement after the fatal shot and some blotching to his skin, his face looks fairly normal to have gone through what he suffered.
And I'm not going to publish the photo again because I think people are tired of seeing it, but I do need for you to describe what kind of things you've observed with the eyes and the bones with people that you've seen that have been struck or shot in the back of the head at point blank range.
Yes, sir. Well, it's not always the back. Now, I've seen some from the side also.
From any
angle. Yes, sir. Generally, like I said, it looks like the facial features have gone away, or they've at least changed drastically. A lot of times you will get large blood pockets or contusions under the eyes if the eyes don't pop out. A lot of times the eyes will pop out and they'll be on what's left of the cheeks. The facial bones, you can grab them with a gloved hand and you can move them around. And you will actually have pellet exits in the skin flap. If you pull the skin up, you can see where the pellets, whether they be buckshot or close distance birdshot, you can see the actual defects from those pellets.
Based on your training and your many years of law enforcement experience, are the wounds suffered to Paul at the back of the head consistent with a contact shot to the back?
Absolutely not, in my opinion.
Okay, Dr. Kinsey, we'll move on from that for just a second. You were here yesterday, correct?
I was.
Did you have the opportunity to observe, I want to say his name correctly, I believe it was Tim Palmbach?
I did.
He was a crime scene investigator who was qualified as an expert for the defense. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would... He came up with two significant conclusions, you could say three, about how Paul was shot at the feed room. Do you remember what those were for this jury?
The big one that I recall is that Paul was shot in the back of the head with a contact wound. And the other one, the strikes in my mind, I don't know, the shooter passed him and shot him from inside the feed room. Those are the two big ones that I recall.
There was another one regarding the number of people there. Was there?
The thing about two shooters, yes, sir.
Okay. We'll get to that in a minute. I would like to... Doug, can you get the Elmo up? Exhibit 182. What's that a picture of?
That's a picture of that expert with his hands cupped opposite the hinges on the door frame.
Okay. I want to leave this picture up for a moment, because what is the direction that the picture was taken from?
From inside the feed room.
Facing what direction?
Outside the feed room.
Okay. Now, you had an opportunity to hear the defense's theory on how Paul was shot, correct?
Yes, sir, I did.
I would like to demonstrate that with you right now.
Yes, sir.
Can you walk us through the defense's theory as you understood it to be?
Yes, sir, I can.
Your Honor, for purposes of this demonstration, I don't know if the court would allow it, but it'd be nice if we could open this door. I want to make sure that there's security here, but if we could have that door open just for a minute or two.
Can you open that door?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm grabbing what Smart Estates Exhibit 4, which is a camo Benelli Super Black Eagle 3 shotgun 12 gauge. We'll use this for the demonstration, so step down. Now, is this door the same width as the feed room door?
It's a couple inches wider than the feed room door.
And of course, the feed room door doesn't have this, you know, it's inset, correct?
That is correct.
So this is not exactly a replication of what happened at the feed room door, correct?
No, sir, it's not. The door swings the same direction, though.
Now, you have given me permission, I'm very careful about muzzle velocity, muzzle awareness, but you've given me permission to point this at you, correct?
I have.
Okay. You actually asked me to, correct?
Yes, sir, I did.
All right. So go in there and stand a couple of feet back. It doesn't have to be 5 feet, but you have since testified that Paul was 5 feet inside the feed room, correct?
Can we demonstrate the first shot out here?
I am.
I believe they...
All right, stand back a little bit, because you got to stumble toward me.
Yes, sir.
So I'm going to point like I'm pointing at you.
Yes, sir.
Paul is shot.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the shooter approximately outside the door?
The breech face or the ejection port of the shotgun is just past the door frame.
Okay, Paul has just been shot.
Yes, sir.
And in the defense's theory, you tell me what to do, and you act this out, and I'm going to do what you tell me to do based on the defense's theory of the case.
The defense agreed with the assessment that Paul stood there for a moment, bleeding down his injured left arm, and he slowly walked toward the door.
Okay, and what does the shooter do?
The shooter's coming in the door.
And then what does the shooter do?
He shoots Paul in the back of the head after he passes him.
Okay, and then shoots Paul in the back of the head like this, and where does the blood spatter go?
The blood spatter, the pellet defects, and one that I didn't know about that the expert collected was in the door frame at the top of the door.
Now I understand this is a little different than the feed room door. That's the best we can do. So what did you find odd about the theory, first of all?
I think the theory is preposterous, in my opinion.
Can you walk me through why you think it's preposterous?
Absolutely. Number one, that dry lock number two shot shell fires a projectile at 1,450 feet per second once it leaves the muzzle of that weapon. As was mentioned, that's a millisecond. That's fast. To think that the pressure from flesh and bone will cause that pellet, those steel pellets now, we're not talking about lead. Lead's a little bit more giving. Lead is malleable. It will crush or flatten. We're talking about steel, BB pellets. They will turn around because of the pressure, go back the opposite direction, 180 degree direction at enough velocity to dent a steel exterior door and embed in the door frame. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. In my opinion.
I don't know if you mentioned this earlier, but can you talk about, make sure I get it right.
And can I add?
Please do.
Also, there's no defects to the OSB or the T111 siding in the bottom of the room.
All right, wait a second. You said a lot right there.
Yes, sir.
TS what?
TS111. It's like a exterior paneling that people put on their buildings. That's what's on the building.
For all us city boys, we appreciate you describing that. Thank you.
Yes, sir. It's a whole weather paneling. There's no defects at the bottom. And if that theory is correct, if this is an entrance and this is an exit, the shot still had to go somewhere. There's no defects down there on anything. The door frame, as I mentioned in my previous testimony, the door frame has a clean void. That would be perfectly in line with those shot from that shot shell. There's no cracks, chips, pellet holes in the cement. There's nothing in the OSB. That's cheap plywood. That's man-made plywood. There's no defects in the plywood. There's no high-velocity blood spatter on the floor. What was pointed out to you is medium velocity, and that's from coming out of the wound and gravity bringing it down to the floor. You would see a pattern on the floor just like what you can see in the photographs at the top of that door. None of that's there. So I have to look at the science, and I have to look at inertia, and I have to look at that shot shell and how fast that shell is propelled out of that barrel. And I know that it can't turn around 180 degrees and go back the other direction. It's not like blood and tissue. We're talking about steel pellets.
Dr. Kinsey, are there studies on percentages of blowback when you're shooting into someone?
There are.
And based on your expert opinion, what percentage of blowback would come back at a shooter if they were able to shoot at that angle?
Well, I don't think there's any definite, but what I read is 8 to 10%, except in, you know, like I said, it's not an absolute every time, but 8 to 10%. Remember, the most of your force is going out the front of the barrel.
And a moment ago, you were just talking about the defects and all of the trauma that would have happened to the paneling and the floor. Can you point on this photo with the dowel stick behind you for the jury? I just want them to see in this photo.
Right here,
The void, as I documented in my original testimony, the void was from here down, other than one stray satellite drop of blood, that was fairly clean from here to at least right here. But there's no defects here. There's no defects in that cement outside. There's no defects in the inside cement, and none in this OSB right here. And that was still there when I did the tour. They ripped out all the shelving and some of the insulation, but this was still there.
Dr. Kinsey, you may have covered this a little bit, but explain for the jury, if someone is shooting down, as we just demonstrated a moment ago here in the doorway, you're leaning out, the shooter is shooting down, how do pellets get embedded into the door frame up here? How is that possible?
I think it's impossible myself. Physics don't work that way unless you're shooting into a trampoline or a huge piece of steel, and then you may have a pellet deflected back on you. It happens many times, especially when we're shooting steel targets, but not at that velocity. It will not sink into the door frame, and it definitely will not dent that door with what I documented, in my opinion.
What is the restate for this jury what the defense's theory based on that blowback that would have exploded into the shooter's face here behind Paul. Explain for this jury what the defense's theory is about how that shooter would have been injured.
The defense expert testified that that shooter would be most probably incapacitated from blood, bone, and body fluid, and it was a high likelihood that he was injured by those pellets.
Dr. Kinsey, in your expert opinion, is there anything awkward about a shooter standing outside going into an enclosed area to turn around to shoot someone from enclosed? Is there something weird about that to you?
I can't figure out the methodology of a shooter. I've never done any crime like that, Mr. Wilson, but I don't see, if we talk about common sense and everybody's mentioned the totality when they don't have an answer for something, it's always, I looked at the totality, but I don't see any reason for someone to squeeze up past one victim in this doorway to go inside to shoot him back out. And if he did, if that scenario did happen, that doesn't explain all the pellets that are in the floor of the feed room that we've testified, heard testimony to, as to why law enforcement didn't clean those pellets up. If it happened the way the defense expert says, those pellets would be out here in the yard, they would not be inside that feed room.
Dr. Kinsey, you have had a chance to review the case file on this particular case and observe the defense testimony from last week?
It's two separate things. Yes, sir, I have reviewed our case file. All crime scene, or what I felt was crime scene related evidence. I didn't look into the videos and a lot of that other stuff. And I have witnessed the testimony of the defense experts.
Are you familiar with what the investigation has determined about the tool marks found on the 300 blackout shells found around Maggie's body and the tool marks found on the weathered 300 blackout shells found way up by the house in the flower bed? Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar.
And what do you know about that?
The examination.
Beyond the scope of our case, it's going into completely new information. Their ballistic experts already testified. We didn't present a ballistic expert, and now they're parading him as a ballistic expert.
Your response?
Your Honor, their expert said yesterday, about an hour and 9 minutes into their testimony, that it would be impractical for one shooter to bring in two long guns. It has always been the state's theory that the shooter owned both guns and had them on him. So we're rebutting what the defense expert said.
The objection overruled.
Please answer the question,
Mr.
Dr. Kinsey.
Again, Mr. Wilson, please.
Are you familiar with what the investigation has determined about the 300 blackout shells found around Maggie's body and the 300 blackout shells found up by the flower bed that were appeared to be several months old and weathered? What relationship do the shells have to each other?
According to the firearms examination, those cartridge casings were loaded and ejected from the same weapon.
So a family-owned weapon is what was used to kill Maggie?
Judge, leading.
What do you infer from that information?
I would infer that this is a family-owned firearm.
There was some testimony yesterday, Dr. Kinsey, about, well, it was from the defendant's brother, Mr. John Marvin Murdoch. And it related to the following day, he came upon the crime scene. It had been cleared, and he saw how the crime scene was left. Can you explain, you've been in law enforcement for how many years?
30 years. Well, over 30, but 30 years getting paid.
And you're the chief deputy at a sheriff's department?
Yes, sir, Orangeburg County Sheriff's Office.
Just to clarify some things, can you explain normally or traditionally how crime scenes are cleaned up for this jury? Is it the responsibility of law enforcement, in other words?
No, sir. There are private companies that are contracted through SOVA. Well, it used to be SOVA. The name's changed now, and I'm sorry.
What does SOVA stand for?
It's Victims.
State.
It's a State Office of Victims Assistance, but it's now changed. I can't tell you what the new acronym is. But it works through our victims advocates, law enforcement victims advocates. Almost every department has them. And there's funding provided from taxpayer funds to work through your victims advocates. And you go out and you clean these crime scenes for the families so they don't bear the burden of cleaning those crime scenes. Law enforcement in particular cannot collect and dispose of and transport body parts or body fluids. That's something the coroner has to do because it's actually by permit through DHEC. But to make it easy on the family, these companies can collect those items and then they will turn them over with a chain of custody or they will properly dispose of those items.
Dr. Kinsey, is it your expert opinion that a 6'4" shooter cannot be excluded from the murder of Maggie and Paul?
I see nothing that could exclude a 6'4" shooter.
In your expert opinion, can you tell this jury, is it right for the defense to say that there had to be two shooters based on the testimony you heard yesterday?
Objection.
In your expert opinion, can you exclude two shooters?
I cannot include or exclude two shooters.
Can the defense include, to the exclusion of all other possibilities, two shooters?
Absolutely not.
Beg your pardon, court's indulgence. Please answer any questions the defense has for you.
Mr. Griffin.
Good afternoon, Dr. Kinsey.
Hey, Mr. Griffin.
And anyone who has a doctorate degree, I want to call doctor. It's all right if I call you doctor?
I'll answer to anything you call me, Mr.
Griffin.
I
understand.
I appreciate that.
But now, your degree, though, is in criminal justice. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
You're not a doctor of pathology?
Absolutely not.
And you have no medical training?
I have training in pathology of gunshot wounds. Yes, sir. I've attended several courses, classes, and seminars. It was also included in the criteria for the certifications I mentioned for the International Association for Identification. I've also conducted extensive research on police officer use of force cases and the injuries that result from therein.
Your doctorate is in criminal justice, and I believe your dissertation research is in use of force and perceptions of public attitude held by police trainers?
That is correct.
What was that?
Well, with the current atmosphere or what's been going on the last 5 or 6 years in our country, I was just trying to help. I wanted to figure out something that would assist with, because we've seen some law enforcement officers do some terrible things on video. We've got a segment of our society, the minority segment of our population. A lot of those citizens are in fear of law enforcement, and I wanted to study if the media perception as held by the three types of law enforcement trainers, if the media perception and the way they portray law enforcement, if that affected the way we train our officers, if we're too hypervigilant, or if we, you know, we tell them, look, there's death waiting for you around every corner. Is that going to make law enforcement more prone to use force or use less force or those kind of criteria? And that's what I was interested in. I was laying the groundwork with a scientific quantitative study to allow someone to come behind me and do some further research just to expand that topic.
Right. But you've said you also have done some gunshot wound training as part of some certification?
Yes, sir. The IAI, as I mentioned, I was formally certified two different times. I think it's a 5-year certification. And I did let it lapse in 2015 because that's when I started my PhD and I couldn't study for both. But that is an extensive process where you do research and you have to do a written test, and then with my proficiencies throughout SLED, and then I still do some with our sheriff's office now where you have to pass proficiency, and that is practical examinations, testing, and that kind of thing.
Okay. Now, in this case, that the state did have a pathologist, Dr. Reamer, correct?
Yes, sir, they did.
And you reviewed her autopsy report as part of your work, correct?
Not so much as reviewed her report, but I went and spoke with her in Charleston at her office.
Well, did you review her report?
I have access to her report, Mr. Griffin. I can't tell you. I looked through the whole report.
And you understood that her opinion was it was a shoulder shot through the neck and then up out of the top of the head. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I believe we agreed on that. Yes,
sir. And your reconstruction opinion is that's the exact same angle that Paul was shot by the shooter. Shoulder, neck, out the top of the head.
Yes, sir, but I didn't just rely on her information. I also looked at the crime scene photographs, and I went to the scene myself.
I understand.
Yes, sir.
But, and then you, did you hear Dr. Eisenstadt, his testimony?
I did.
Now, you worked with SLED, did you not?
I did, yes, sir.
Dr. Eisenstadt worked for GBI, correct?
Yes, sir.
SLED does not have its own in-house division of medical examiners, do they?
No, sir. There are several fine medical examiners throughout the state. I've done autopsies in a lot of the bigger cities in South Carolina.
Dr. Eisenstadt worked, and he was the chief medical examiner toward the end of at GBI, correct?
That's what he testified to. I don't know that doctor.
You didn't know of him before this case?
I did not. No, okay. Sir.
Now, he says his opinion is it was a gunshot wound contact to the back of the head. Is that correct?
That is what he testified to. Yes, sir.
And if he is correct, then your opinion is incorrect. Is that right?
I don't share the same opinion as that doctor. But yes, if he would be correct, that would make me incorrect.
Okay. Now, in your training, are you familiar with Mr. DeMeo's book on gunshot wounds?
I have read DeMeo. I've heard it described as the Bible. I don't consider, no do my cohorts consider that as the gunshot Bible. There's four or five different versions out. There's one called Terminal Ballistics by Dobb, and there's also one Gunshot Wounds by Doherty. And those are the ones that I'm more familiar with. But I'm not saying it's a bad textbook, and I'm not saying that the information in it's not correct.
Okay. Now, and we'll get to more of that in a moment. What I'd like to do is first address Mr. Sutton's work that you had criticisms of.
Well, I didn't have criticisms. We just have different opinions. He's an engineer, and I'm a crime scene investigator, okay. Mr. Griffin.
Well, it seems like you said that
the angles of the into the quail pen were unreliable.
Absolutely.
Okay. And
I have several more criteria that I didn't mention earlier, but I mean, if you want me to go into those, I will.
Well, I want to ask you first, what's your understanding as to how those measurements were taken? Who took those measurements in the quail pen?
The original angles were the original SLED crime scene agent that responded to the scene.
Right.
And took those angles.
And you understand that Mr. Sutton relied upon Agent Worley's measurements?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Now you were putting a dowel, shoving it in a box and taking it out of a box as if Mr. Sutton went back and tried to remeasure it.
No, sir, that's not what I was insinuating. I said when the original agent removed her dowel, it wasn't nefarious, but depending on how she removed that dowel, she could have altered that impact.
Well, let's take a look at that, Doug. And this is Defendant's Exhibit 140. And can you pull that up? The one you were showing with the state. Excuse me. Just go to the second slide to start with. There you go. So you understood from this exhibit that Mr. Sutton relied solely on the shot trajectories measured by Agent Worley.
As I said, it wasn't his intentions, Mr. Griffin. It was his results that I disagree with. It's not absolute. And he gave, in my opinion, an absolute opinion to this.
Well, why would Special Agent Worley take measurements if someone should not rely upon them?
I can't answer that. You'd have to ask Special Agent Worley. But in my opinion, the direction, even though she can't obtain a perfect angle of impact, or even if that weathered cardboard was damaged, it's not a good substance to depend on because it's just not hardy enough. And she was showing direction. I'm not saying the direction's wrong. I'm just saying I wouldn't put confidence reviewing this case or work in this case. I would not put confidence in anything that angle of impact tells me because it's cardboard.
All right, so if you can go to slide number 7, I believe I've numbered them correctly. And do you recognize that as being one of her measurements?
I do, yes, sir.
And do you think she took the dowel out and then put it back in to put this measuring device?
No, Mr. Griffin, I didn't say the angle. I said the angle of impact. When he was talking about the bullet wipe, and that part, that's what I was referring to, and that's what I'm saying, that hole can be altered when you remove those dowel rods. That shows direction, but that direction, I don't place a lot of confidence in it because we have more cartridge casings and we have injuries on Miss Maggie Murdoch. We don't know if this bullet struck Miss Maggie Murdoch. If it struck anyone else, we don't know that the defect in that doghouse struck Miss Maggie Murdoch. Those are unknowns that we don't know. So all this proves to me is that the shooter was moving, and more than likely, Miss Maggie Murdoch was moving.
All right, hang on. So Doug, if you'll back up one to number 6. So are you suggesting that this photograph, number 6, taken by SLED, Agent Worley, that was taken after the dowel was removed or before a dowel was put in there?
Mr. Griffin, I don't know. That's what I'm telling you. I don't know how it was altered when she removed the dowel. I wouldn't place confidence in this before inserting the dowel because it's paper. It's not something hardy.
Well, would your opinions be different if you knew she took the picture first before inserting the dowel?
It would still be irrelevant except for direction because we know we had a moving shooter, we know we had a moving victim, and we can't prove one way or the other whether the projectile that caused this defect struck Miss Maggie Murdoch.
All right, so if you'll go to slide 8. Again, this is Agent Worley's measurements of a dowel in the hole. Is that correct?
Same picture. Yes, sir.
Well, let's go to number nine. It's a little closer. And is this measuring up and down or left and right? Horizontal or vertical?
That is up and down.
Okay.
And I wasn't going to mention this, but the actual protractor or level finder is backwards. It would be a much more confident angle if the flat edge was up against the substance, but I wasn't going to bring that out.
And SLED did this, not?
SLED did that, yes, sir. But I don't know what her intentions were. Like I said, she could have just been trying to show direction. I don't know that, Mr. Griffin.
Well, this is direction, but it's up and down direction, right?
Yes, sir. It's showing angle of impact also.
Right. And if you had confidence in the angle of impact, you could do, whether you're doing it with a ferro system or just, you know, the old-fashioned way with some sort of colored twine. I mean, it's a legitimate way to determine shot angles.
I don't know what it would prove, and I've run it through my head a million times. I don't know what more it would prove other than you've got a moving victim, you've got a moving shooter, and that at some point in time, Miss Maggie Murdoch was over there in the vicinity of that quail pen. And we know that because we identified that tire tread impression on her leg as being from that Polaris or another tire just like it.
Okay.
So I know that already.
So if you go to slide 12, please, which is exhibit 70. So you know that this shot angle through the quail pen also went through the feed room. I mean, excuse me, through the shed, through that wooden wall. I mean, that wooden wall there, correct?
I don't think I observed a photograph of the inside of the shed. I may have, but I don't believe I ever observed that.
Well, do you see number 12 going all the way through? This is the dowel that goes from the outside, the inside, and then on through the backside of the quail pen.
I see it being held up by the cardboard and the rabbit wire, but I don't know what's behind that cardboard.
You're unaware that it actually went through the wood there. You didn't know that.
I do not know. And like I said, I don't see what it would prove. I don't see any more that it would prove than you've got a moving suspect and a moving victim.
Well, if the measurement included going through fixed wood siding, that would give you more confidence that the angle is accurate, would it not?
Yes, sir. But the angle itself will prove no more for me than direction, because what this proves to me is at some point in time, Miss Maggie Murdoch was close to this quail pen. If this shot is related, and I have no reason to believe it's not, and my shooter was moving, my victim was moving. I don't know forensically what else that can prove.
Well, you can certainly measure the angle of the bullet entrance to the quail pen and calculate backwards to see where that shot was fired from.
You could, yes, sir.
And that's what Mr. Sutton did he not?
He did, and I never disagreed with his direction. I'm disagreeing with his final analysis or his final result that you can judge how tall a shooter is without knowing a whole lot of other variables.
Well, you understood that Mr. Sutton said that the gun, the barrel was somewhere on that line at some to make the shot angle.
Moving back and forth on that line. Yes, sir. Yeah. I heard his testimony.
And that he picked a spot and said if you put the gun at a hip level to get on that line, he used a 5'2 person as an example.
Exclusively, yes, sir. I do.
But he did not say the person had to be 5'2, did he? I mean, we all know it could be dynamic. A 5'8, 6-foot person can get low.
What I gathered from his testimony is it was his opinion that only a person in that height range could have fired that weapon. That was my opinion.
Well, his opinion was that it would be a shooter at 6'4", it would be an unnatural position for them to fire at that low of a level.
And that's the part I disagree with. I don't know how Mr. Sutton could publish an opinion about what's natural or unnatural.
Well, if it's someone 6'4", and the the muzzle of the gun is being fired at 28 inches off the ground. I mean, the 6'4 person either's got to get down on the ground or hold it down below their knees. Isn't that correct?
I have demonstrated several different ways, depending on distance and height, that a shooter can shoot. We don't know. We don't have a video of it, Mr. Griffin.
Right. But Mr. Sutton's methodology, what I'm hearing you now is you don't have a real dispute to his methodology.
He's an engineer. Yes, sir.
Okay. What you dispute is the accuracy of the angle coming out of the quail pen because of the construction being cardboard. Is that right?
Yes, sir. I said that if I was investigating that and even reviewing that case as a consult, I put little or no confidence in that angle of the impact of that cardboard. Now, I put much greater confidence in the one for the dog kennel.
Okay. Well, let's see if we can. You mentioned you had a fair amount of confidence in the, at least one of the angles coming out of the quail pen, right? Left or right?
The direction, yes, sir.
The direction. Mm-hmm. And so that's, take a look at that right quick. And Doug, if you'll go to
time, please go to the jury room. Please not discuss the case.
That wraps up segment number 4 in our continuing coverage of the trial of Alec Murdaugh. There is more to come. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.